Straits brings legal and business insights at the intersection of the shipping and energy sectors. This podcast series offers trends, developments, challenges, and topics of interest from Reed Smith litigation, regulatory, and finance lawyers across our network of global offices. If you have any questions about the topics discussed on this podcast, please do contact our speakers.
Hi, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of the Reed Smith Trading Straits podcast. My name is Susan Riedler. I'm a partner in the asset finance team in the transportation group at Reed Smith. I'm joined today by Katrina Henderson, counsel in the asset finance team, and we are both based in the London office. So we're going to talk a little bit about offshore finance today. So let's start with an intro into it as a concept and what sorts of things we're seeing. So I'll start with a question. Katrina, what comes to your mind when you hear the term offshore finance?
Well, offshore energy refers to the generation of energy from various different sources located in offshore areas. So that could mean oil and gas, wind, wave, tidal, and other renewable resources located in offshore areas. There's a wide range of offshore projects ranging from oil drilling and production platforms, offshore wind farms, and offshore solar farms. And these projects all need vessels. The focus today is on offshore vessel financing rather than project financing. So we will talk a bit about the pressure points and what issues may come up if you are looking at financing offshore vessels in particular. I should say here that offshore vessels can include oil rigs, FPSOs, and other large structures, but can also include offshore supply vessels, commissioning service operation vessels for wind farms, or anchor handling vessels for oil platforms. So we're talking here about moving assets as well as fixed assets. And as Susan mentioned, we're both transactional shipping lawyers, and we work on a lot of asset finance deals with a vessel mortgage as the key security. But offshore financing isn't always that simple. And in particular with oil platforms, you have to consider whether the rig actually counts as a vessel that can be registered under a particular flag, and therefore whether a mortgage can be granted over it. And depending on the jurisdictions involved, this isn't always a foregone conclusion. And investors looking to get a vessel mortgage over an oil rig might be a bit surprised when they find that the rig doesn't actually qualify as a vessel under a particular flag, and security needs to be structured differently. For example, you could have a chattel mortgage. This is, of course, an area where we can help clients structure the deal to get the most robust security package possible, taking into account the asset and the jurisdiction in question. So Susan, a question for you. I mean, we're talking today about offshore finance because we think it's a bit of a hot topic. And why is that? Why is it a bit of a thing right now?
Yeah, you're right, Katrina. It is a really hot topic. It seems like you can't swing a cat at the moment in the shipping sphere without coming up against someone doing an offshore deal somewhere. Renewable energy generation is growing worldwide. There are a lot of government initiatives globally encouraging investment in renewable projects, offshore projects, and that can make financing offshore vessels much more financially viable than previously. For example, Denmark has committed to increasing its wind energy capacity fivefold by 2030. The G7 countries have agreed to reach net zero emissions in the shipping industry by 2050. And the increased use of offshore renewable energy is a key driving force behind that. And when you couple that with the International Maritime Organization's decarbonization goals, which are to reach net carbon zero by 2050, there are a lot of investment opportunities out there.
Yes, and I think to add to that, the oil and gas industry has been through a bit of a tough period of late. And as we know, there's been quite a lot of companies that have ended up filing for bankruptcy protection. But a lot of those companies are now emerging from those restructurings with much stronger balance sheets, and coupled with rising profits, which have been fueled sadly by the situation in Ukraine, many of these companies are now looking to invest in new projects.
Absolutely. I mean, there's a huge need for investment in this market, and you know, various market players are predicting exponential growth here in the long term, certainly very attractive to investors. If you think about offshore deals involving oil platforms, FPSOs, these are vessels that are usually employed on long-term contracts. We're talking 10, 15, 20 years. So you have potentially long-term income stream to service loans in this industry. Looking more at offshore vessels in general, the technology can be really complex. The technology is evolving super fast, and that can mean that existing vessels can stop being fit for purpose, and you then need more investment to keep up with the latest developments. I guess a good example of that would be if you look at wind turbines, you need vessels to transport your turbine blades to the wind farm. Blades are getting bigger and bigger all the time, meaning that the existing transport and installation vessels may no longer work because they can't carry turbine blades big enough. So again, you'll need a substantial investment to upgrade fleets going forward. And offshore projects are really small, right? So the sheer scale of these projects means that there's a lot of cash needed to make them work. We're certainly no investment advisors, but you can see why a bank or a fund would be looking at this with interest.
Indeed. So I think we're going to move on now to have a think about what some of the challenges and risks and other points to bear in mind are when considering investing in the offshore space. And one of the big points, I think, both in every sense of the word, is cost. The sheer scale and expense of many offshore projects means that the sums of money involved can be vast. However, to make things more workable, potential financiers can maybe consider putting together club deals or perhaps entering into a JV with a partner, particularly if that partner has more specialist knowledge of the sector. We've certainly seen ourselves quite a few deals recently where funds have entered into JVs with experienced players in the market.
Yeah, for sure. And I guess if we think about, in addition to cost, I guess other challenges would be one big point that comes up all the time when we're talking about ship finance in general, but in particular, offshore installations, we're talking about oil platforms or FPSOs, it's pollution liability and the associated risk that comes with that. I guess it's worth mentioning a little bit about that. I mean, oil spills are the obvious risk here. I mean, that's less of a concern probably for your standard, you know, CSOV or anchor supply handling vessels, but offshore covers so much that, you know, we should be looking at that from a sort of oil platform FPSO point of view. But if you're thinking about pollution risk, that can make a potential investor quite nervous, because offshore accidents that we see are usually really large scale because of just the sheer size of the installations, the volume of oil involved if something does go wrong, and these incidents are front page news. We've all read about them. So the consequence of this is the liability costs, cleanup costs are often in the billions. So the question becomes, who is actually paying for that? So let's say we have an oil spill. The first thing to bear in mind is that liability regime would often be dictated by where that occurs. So local law will always be relevant. There are some international conventions, such as the Civil Liability Convention of 1992, that deals with how liability is addressed. And under the CLC, liability is strict and it always falls on the registered owner in the first instance, regardless of fault. And you can see why. I mean, there are public policy reasons for that, because governments want someone to be responsible and get the spill cleaned up. They don't want to have to wait for the parties to argue amongst themselves as to who is liable. I mean, if we're looking at a substantial incident, the first port of call in case of a spill is the P&I club. And that's great, you know, you're insured for your oil spill, but there is a maximum cap for how much the P&I club would cover.
Yeah, you might be used to seeing covenants and facility agreements that borrowers are required to ensure that P&I cover is taken out for the maximum amount available in the market, which at the moment is 1 billion.
And, you know, you'd like to think that oil spills wouldn't be that expensive, but they can result in costs exceeding that 1 billion. And in those cases, the owner would be looking to other alternatives to find the cash. The CLC that I mentioned just now does include some maximum liability caps. And there are funds called International Oil Pollution Compensation Funds that can provide further compensation over the P&I club liability limit. So, you know, there are ways to deal with that. But I suppose, you know, we're talking about offshore financing, so people are probably asking, well, why do I care about this if I'm the financier? We've just said that the registered owner is liable. And in principle, that's true. But depending on local law, a mortgage could be liable in some cases, especially where they're seen to exercise significant control over the operation of the vessel. In most standard financings, where you've got control only through sort of loan agreement covenants, making sure that the borrower is maintaining the vessel properly and things like that, that would be unlikely to be an issue. But there is, you know, some concern that a government involved might try to go after a mortgagee because they're likely to have the deepest pockets.
Yeah, I think you've got a good point there. And on top of the financial risk, I guess you've also got a reputational risk, because I suspect few financiers would be happy to have their name linked to an oil spill or other major environmental incident. And I think it's also worth pointing out here that there is an even bigger risk in lease financing, where the financier would be the registered owner of the vessel and so would be likely to be the first person held liable, even if they had nothing to do with the incident. On the more positive side, financiers can take out insurance policies to help protect their position. Whilst the mortgage on a vessel might be lost or impaired if a pollution claim can be enforced against the vessel with priority over the mortgage, a lender can take out mortgagee's additional perils pollution insurance cover, and that's usually at the expense of the borrower. In addition, if you had a lease deal, the lessor can get lessor's liability insurance. And just as an aside, many oil and gas companies set up their own captive insurance companies to insure their own operations. And as a financier, you would want to require that close to 100% of the insured value is reinsured with substantial insurers in the reinsurance market, and then such reinsurances on assigned to you as financier.
Yeah, that's a really good point, and quite different from something that we see necessarily in a sort of standard commercial vessel financing, where you've got the sort of usual suspects as the insurance. I guess some other issues to point out, the pollution one is a big one, but if we look at enforcement from the point of view of the financier, if you're financing a rig or an FPSO that isn't moving, it's in practice quite a lot easier to arrest it because it's not going anywhere. But it might be harder to sell than a commercial vessel, given that these vessels are so specialized and they're really, really expensive. So you probably won't find a ready market for that very easily. Whereas if we're talking about offshore support vessels, then the arrest issues are more similar to your usual commercial vessels. But I guess one thing to bear in mind there is that OSVs are usually used in local projects in territorial waters. So you have wind farm off the coast of a particular jurisdiction and the vessels are sailing there. So you're always going to be arresting potentially just in that one jurisdiction, and it might not always be the most inviting jurisdiction to arrest. So just something for lenders to be aware of at the outset of the project.
Absolutely. And I think another point for financiers to bear in mind is the possibility of market volatility. By definition, offshore projects are big projects and the market highly susceptible to fluctuations, which can be influenced by factors such as oil prices, global demand for resources, and geopolitical tensions. And we've seen examples of that recently with Ukraine. And fluctuations in these variables can impact the vessel's utilization rates and thereby affect the cash flows that might be available for debt service. So that's something to bear in mind, particularly considering that offshore projects are long term. It can take years to build an offshore wind farm, and drilling contracts for oil platforms are usually pretty long, like 15, 20 years. So patience is a virtue here, and things can change quickly. However, they can also change back just as quickly. And also, as mentioned earlier, those long-term drilling contracts can help ensure a predictable revenue stream, despite what might be going on around. So whilst there might be volatility in the market, you might have a steady income stream, and that can help guard against the volatility.
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess in connection with that, offshore investment can be helpful in kind of in diversifying a portfolio. A lot of times the returns from offshore investments are not necessarily directly correlated with traditional equity or fixed income markets. So there is, like you say, there is volatility, but it isn't necessarily the same volatility that you might see in the kind of economy as a whole. So it may potentially provide a bit of a hedge against wider economic risks.
Absolutely. And I think a last point that we wanted to raise was around working with trusted partners. It's really important to be working with experienced counterparties who understand the technologies involved in the sector, because it's always changing, and as we've discussed, there are challenges involved in being involved in the market. So it's really essential to have knowledge and experience of the market and to understand those challenges and quirks. And so if you don't have that knowledge yourself, you want to ensure that others involved do have that knowledge. And as we've mentioned earlier, you could consider partnering someone in a JV or a strategic alliance.
Yeah, thanks, Katrina. I mean, I think we've covered some interesting points there, and I think we can wrap it up. Thank you, everyone, very much for listening, and we look forward to another Trading Straits podcast soon.
Trading Straits is a Reed Smith production. Our producer is Ali McArdle. For more information about Reed Smith's energy and natural resources or transportation practices, please email tradingstraits@reedsmith.com. You can find our podcast on Spotify, Apple, Google, Stitcher, and reedsmith.com, and our social media accounts at reedsmithllp on LinkedIn, Facebook, and Twitter.
This podcast is provided for educational purposes. It does not constitute legal advice and is not intended to establish an attorney-client relationship, nor is it intended to suggest or establish standards of care applicable to particular lawyers in any given situation. Prior results do not guarantee a similar outcome. Any views, opinions, or comments made by any external guest speaker are not to be attributed to Reed Smith LLP or its individual lawyers. All rights reserved.